Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com/contests. Test your movie knowledge and win a Nintendo Wii when you join the scavenger hunt at Spout.com/contests, going on right now.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. This week, Carrie, Miranda, Charlotte, and Samantha sweet talk Adam and I into sharing our top five best-dressed movie characters.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Anne McHugh, and the fifth movie in our 70s sci-fi marathon, Logan's Run. But first, a few weeks ago on the show, Maddie, actually about a month ago, we had a poll question that we posed to our listeners. We wanted to know what their least anticipated movie of the summer was, and one of the choices we included in there was the film Sex and the City. And we got this response from listener Liz Jewerts. Dudes, at least have a couple of female guest critics sit in for that review. Perhaps you are not the intended audience. Well, perhaps not, but we did listen to Liz, and we went out and got a guest female reviewer to sit in for this segment. We're very pleased to welcome in Jessica Reeves from the Chicago Tribune. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, now that we all have our cosmos in hand, let's go ahead and hear a clip from the trailer for Sex and the City.
Give me a kiss goodnight. It's the last single girl kiss.
The ultimate single gal, Carrie Bradshaw, will be married to John James Preston come fall.
Should we get you a diamond?
No, just get me a really big closet.
After years of living in the city, I assumed that if my friends and I ever got our fairy tale endings, that would be the end of the story.
Hello.
Welcome home, baby.
I always knew she'd marry big.
You thought that after the second breakup?
Yep.
After the 15th?
Uh-huh. We broke up a lot.
But real life?
200 people?
But don't you want...
I want you. That's what I want.
Always has a twist.
Well, I actually think a lot of people would accuse us of sort of insulating ourselves from criticism this week by adding a female voice to review Sex and the City. I thought it was interesting during the 30-minute red carpet segment that we were treated to prior to the movie starting on Tuesday night. Wow. Did not let the critics know, actually, that 7:30 was not the start time. One of the stars of the movie, or I don't know, someone related to the movie, said in a rather sort of throwaway fashion that this movie is critic-proof. And now I could actually hear Adam's teeth gritting the second that he said that. I didn't think much of the comment until last night. We mentioned that we had seen Sex and the City to the class that we're teaching through the University of Chicago. And the first question out of their mouths was not, is it good, but rather, were the clothes gorgeous? And it got me thinking, my God, maybe this damn thing is critic-proof. So I want to ask you, Jessica, Michael Phillips has outed you as a devotee, a rabid devotee of the show,
well, not quite.
Sex and the City. Can you appreciate this film both as a critic and as a fan, or is this film packaged in so much Teflon that sort of oafish jackanapes like Adam and I really should just sort of sit back and smile and marvel at those gorgeous outfits because they were absolutely gorgeous?
Well, I'm glad you appreciated the outfits. I'm sure that they would look lovely on you as well. Is the movie critic-proof? Yes, but it doesn't need to be. I think it actually stands up as a movie. I think it's certainly better than or as good as certainly some of the movies that have come out recently geared towards women. It's a heck of a lot better than 27 Dresses. It's got pathos and it's got real tears and it's got emotion and heft. And the other thing this movie has going for it, which I think you can't really understate, is a history. People have an emotional connection to these characters and they care what happens to them.
Well, and you know, actually I had a real connection to them immediately, and I wasn't a fan of the show really much.
Are you
at
kidding?
All. I'm really not kidding. And I think that's a tribute to the fact that these actors had played these characters for so long that immediately they became really, really familiar to me. I knew what they wanted. I knew what they were all about.
You had
knew...
never seen the show.
I had seen the show, but I had seen the show,
just
but
casually.
I wasn't. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I was really, really surprised. I actually didn't need the little exposition that they throw under the credits. I actually sort of knew who everybody was, and I actually kind of discovered that I'm a bit of a Miranda.
Yeah, okay.
I did not know that. Well, I would put you in the Carrie pile.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll take that. I mean, she is the heroine after all,
right.
But We are going to have a disagreement here.
Really?
Those very delicate ankles of yours.
Yeah, exactly. That may be it. Maddie notices things like that, yeah. And I appreciate that. But I can already anticipate the listeners hearing this and writing in and saying, why did you even review this movie when you knew you were going to hate it? But I didn't know I was going to hate it. I had seen more episodes than you, Maddie. Mm-hmm. I did like the show. And the fact is, these characters are all dealing with issues that we can all relate to, whether we are women of that age or not. It's, you know, these themes about friendship and getting older and, you know, what do you do to find happiness and all those things, all those relationship issues I think we can all relate to. But I have to say, I hated this movie.
No.
I actually really had so little fun with this movie. And maybe it's because I didn't see movies like 27 Dresses and some of the other films maybe of its ilk to compare it to. But I actually just think forgetting everything associated with the movie, you know, sure, I love the outfits too and I love some of the performances, but I actually felt like it was just really incompetently made. Just it needed a director who actually had some sense, and a writer in this case, Michael Patrick King, who could actually make a movie out of that TV series and have it actually function as maybe a longer episode rather than five or six episodes sort of strung together haphazardly. I just felt like it had absolutely no structure. And that was something that was really good about the episodes, is they always had a tight structure. I really could not bear this film.
I could not disagree with you more. I actually felt that this movie didn't feel like an episode of the show, or even five episodes of the show strung together. And I felt that it had a really strong narrative. I felt it had a good sort of thrust, narrative thrust, not to, you know, put too fine a point on it, but
no pun intended.
Right. You know, the most painful part of the evening was certainly the red carpet event at the beginning. But after we sort of got into the movie, I felt I was in very capable hands, very good. It was a great story. You got all your answers. It hit all the notes that I think those of us who followed the show wanted.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, you know, I'm in both of your camps,
actually. Oh, how convenient.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Well, the fact of the matter is I loved how it sort of went big at the beginning. If you're going to take a television series and you're going to make a film, rather than making sort of an elongated episode, then you've got to do something big. And they do something big.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. With that wedding, with the Grace Kelly wedding that goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all right, here we go. We've got some stakes. Let's watch the fallout. About three quarters of the way into the film, when Jennifer Hudson gets introduced into the
equation. So after 5 hours.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Then I can see what Adam's saying. Then I think it became more like, how would a season of Sex and the City deal with this through these plot lines, rather than sort of taking this big idea and rolling with it? And I think maybe that's because you have a love for the series more than we do, more of an affection for it, that you were expecting sort of the outcome.
Yeah, but when you say, oh, it's like stringing five episodes of the series together, I'm not sure that's such a bad thing. I mean, Sex and the City was and remains, when it's shown in its unedited format, stronger than most, certainly most half-hour programs, mm-hmm. and some hour programs on television. So I'm not sure it's the end of the world if we get five episodes of Sex and the City
Maybe
strong
not.
Together.
But I actually have more problems with it.
Oh, good.
Beyond that.
All right. Well,
yeah.
I was wondering.
We could be here all night, unfortunately. But, you know, in terms of the structure, there is a point in the movie, and I agree with you, the wedding sequence is actually great. Up until then, we get the actual fallout in the street, which I think is just horribly awkward and unintentionally funny. I think
I think
the staging's
really
terrible.
I actually thought it was
really
very affecting.
It didn't work for me at all. I thought it was actually, like, uncomfortable. Like,
it's supposed to be uncomfortable.
I hid my eyes. Because of the way it was directed, not because of the uncomfortableness of the scene, I don't think.
He's a TV director, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's done like some Will
and Grace
episodes.
And this is exactly what he did. He made a bunch of little TV episodes and strung them together into a film. He did not make a film really at all, I think, in any way. I mean, there's actually a point where I remember Carrie and Big are like arguing about the wedding. And then literally there's not even a montage of any kind. It just cuts to the wedding. And you have her voiceover and she says, and then before you knew it, the wedding was here. And you're like, really? The wedding was here? That's how we're going to ellipse time? That's what I mean in terms of the structure.
You wanted it
to be
longer?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't.
More
no, I didn't. I actually didn't. But I wish some of those things were handled a little bit better. And, you know, there's even a scene, too, where I remember Samantha comes back and they're like, oh, she's here. And they're all excited. But she was just there 10 minutes ago.
She does come back a lot.
Yeah. And it just.
I didn't
notice
that.
Yeah, but they make that point. They acknowledge that.
I know. But it just like they get all excited to see her when our time, we just saw her 10 minutes ago, and it feels like she was just there.
Yeah, but it's almost
a
full year goes by in the course of this
movie. I didn't get
that
sense of the first. Not between that gap. I mean, those are minor points, but actually, I knew we were in trouble right from the start. You mentioned the montage. The last time I had to sit through a montage like that caught us up on where everybody is now.
It's pretty unoffensive.
It was.
I thought it was
a little gem Maddie called Major League 2. You remember that debacle where they actually spent like the first 20 minutes like trying to fill you in on what happened in Major League 1? And it was like, well, I get that because they have no story there and they're just trying to make a quick buck. So they actually need to fill time with this unnecessary stuff. I just really felt like, why couldn't they assume that, A, most people have either seen it or most people have enough of a sense of the series that we can treat everyone like adults and just sort of start the movie and let the story roll and not waste all that time with that.
All that time? I thought it was so quick. I don't know what you're talking about.
Actually showing us like scenes from the series. Just,
it was really quick.
Movie.
What are you talking about?
No, it was at least 5 minutes and it was boring.
Well, I don't think that's a legitimate concern at all, frankly.
It's never stopped me before.
To your point that they spent too much time reintroducing us to the characters, I was just looking over some of the reviews on RottenTomatoes.com, and there was a male critic, of course he was male, who said, I felt that I was at a party where everybody knew each other, and I was expected to know everybody, but I didn't. And so I just felt like I spent the entire night sort of standing on the sidelines, and no one made an effort to include me. And I actually think that the montage sort of reintroducing us was, you know, it seemed a little bit like overkill to me because I felt, you know, this is on TBS all the time. We have the reruns. Everybody knows what's happening.
Yeah.
But I felt it was sort of a nice inclusive gesture to those people who do not follow the series. And, you know, I didn't think there was anything wrong with it.
I think obviously that's what they were going for. To me, it sort of reeked of the fact that really all they were doing was translating the TV show to the big screen and not envisioning it in any kind of cinematic way. And that's actually my other problem with it. And no, I'm not expecting it to be There Will Be Blood or Citizen Kane or anything like that. But I couldn't believe that for a show that is known for being so glamorous, that's really what everyone thinks about with the show, I was shocked that it could end up looking as bad as it did. I think everything about the cinematography, it looks like a bad TV show. I thought it was incredibly drab other than the outfits. There wasn't anything cinematic about it. And then on top of it, they pride themselves on being the show that's synonymous with New York City, right? It really defines the show, and they've helped define New York City somehow. But you watch it, and except for the one good scene we get on the Brooklyn Bridge, later in the film, where we get a great landmark and they use it well and we get a great panoramic of the city. Other than that, everybody is shot on the streets in these close shots, in either close-ups or like medium shots, where they're totally detached from their environment the entire time, which I think is probably due to the fact that you've got a bunch of characters and who are shooting scenes with crowds that they have to try to shoot around the fact that people are gawking at them. Maybe that was it, but you think about New York movies like any Woody Allen film, Annie Hall or Manhattan or something like that, true Woody Allen, you know, true New York movies that really use the city. I felt like this film could have been shot anywhere. Save for that Brooklyn Bridge scene, this could have been Seattle. And I thought that was something they really lost in the translation to the big screen.
I don't know about that. I mean, I would argue that if Daniel Day-Lewis had worn better clothes in There Will Be Blood, there might have been more close shots. I frankly found that movie to be deeply, deeply overrated.
Okay. Well, I'm just referring to...
I love this. This is my favorite day on film spotting ever.
I'm not trying to get into an argument whether that film was good or bad. I'm simply making a point about the fact that
apparently
the cinematography...
it was good, because that's what the male critics decided. But there were no female characters in that movie, which is why one of the reasons that I found it so incredibly uninteresting. I could appreciate it for what it was, but I almost fell asleep, and by the end, I actually, in the bowling scene, ended up I was laughing in the same way that you were laughing with the scene in the street after the wedding.
Well, so what else about Sex and the City worked for you?
Well, I want to know, were you surprised by any of the characters, what they did here? Was there a new inventiveness to this, or was it sort of old hat? And that was where you sort of drew your enjoyment from.
No, I was actually surprised by the emotional heft of it. I felt that it was actually a bit darker than the series generally was, except in the last season when it got a little bit sort of grim. But I think that there was a real there's a real emotional connection. There were some moments where it was genuinely, there were some sad moments, and I felt this real sense of loss on their behalf, on the different characters' behalf. I think the Miranda Steve situation was really handled well. I thought it was incredibly realistic, actually.
The scripting, though, that's another case where I thought it was so labored, where they tried to make the connections between her storyline and Carrie's, and the writing. I mean, it was so on the nose. I couldn't believe it.
I've had so many conversations that totally square up to that. Not exactly on those lines, but
which,
where you
here
say
it's exact.
Right, but, well, where you say, look, there are parallels here, but you can't see it because you're so wrapped up in your own life. You can't see that you're telling somebody else to do exactly what you refuse to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I think is very specific and very sort of representative of women's relationships with each other, that in a way that maybe male relationships are not. We act as sounding boards for each other. We are each other's amateur therapists. We talk about things in a way that you guys, I know, make fun of all the time, but in
we
fact
do?
Is incredibly
Maddie
you know,
and
cathartic.
I don't.
No, not you guys. I meant
we're
guys
sensitive.
In general, but you know.
Yeah.
So I think that it felt very realistic to me.
Okay. Well, for me, the only real saving grace here was actually Kristen Davis. I just thought she was charming, and I loved every comedic moment except for her big
That's
comedic
so funny,
moment,
I
which
actually
didn't
thought,
work.
I actually thought she was a little over the top.
No, I liked
her. I didn't know these
every
characters.
Every time she was on screen,
I
smiled.
I thought Cynthia Nixon and Kim Cattrall were fantastic.
I think they're all fine.
Their comic timing
yeah.
is perfect.
It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really, really enjoyed that. Jennifer Hudson, unfortunately, I think might have to give her Oscar back.
You actually
Although,
said that to me during the film, and I agreed with you.
I was glad, though, that they injected a woman of color in here, though, so it didn't suffer
but it
from the Friends
I mean, the whole
but
thing,
it doesn't quite work.
Let's give you a nice shiny bag, and you'll work for us. I don't know.
Well, she
I
couldn't quite carry. She just couldn't quite carry it. I mean,
no.
She was trying so hard, and it just didn't quite work.
I found her interesting, Jennifer Hudson's character interesting, in the sense that it provided Carrie, you know, sort of. And I know that this was a bit labored in terms of themes, but it did provide Carrie the chance to. And the filmmakers a chance to sort of see everything through this lens of youth again.
That's
so
true.
It's sort
exactly,
of like take it back to square one and sort of look, because the whole movie is very nostalgic.
Yeah.
I mean, nostalgia sort of is the overarching sentiment, which is maybe why I found it sort of dark, because I felt maybe I was also thinking back, you know, to my carefree days in New York when, you know, things were better and easier, of course, as they always are in the past.
Yeah, of
course. I lived in New York. I could never afford anything these things these people are doing.
You're
I
always happier when
But in
you're
your mind,
poor,
you can.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely,
yes.
Right.
In your imagination.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, the problems I had with it were, like I said, about 3/4 of the way in when it became sort of the filmic things that he tries, like the montage of interviewing the assistants.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
No.
I mean, that's a montage we've seen time and time again throughout movies. But at the end of the day, and I don't want to make this sound trite, but I'm not a big TV guy, but I remember we only had one television station when I grew up in Minnesota in the country. But every Monday night, it was Murphy Brown and Northern Exposure. And
Garrison Keillor.
And Garrison, exactly.
Right.
And Garrison Keillor.
He came and fixed the television afterwards.
Exactly. And you felt so comfortable with those gang of people. And at the end of this film, again, I just felt like I had spent a really nice 2 hours with a really comfortable gang of people. I felt like it was a long TV show.
Yeah.
But in the end, I did like it.
Wow.
And you know what's interesting is I don't think the distinction between filmic and whatever the equivalent word is for television, I don't think that sort of contrast stands so much anymore, because we're all talking about how so many television directors now are shooting in these very sophisticated sort of quote-unquote filmic ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting that you point out that it felt like it was being shot as a television show. I don't think that means the same thing.
No, it doesn't, except for the fact that I would agree, because in this case you have a very uninspired, unimaginative director. Is what I would say, who shoots it like your average TV show. Unfortunately for me, it didn't work. And whether, Maddie, we were trying to hedge our bets or save ourselves some criticism by having a female guest critic, I think it worked. I'm very
so glad
she
did.
Was here.
I feel like, you know, Jimmy Carter at the Peace Accords.
I know.
Think it's terrific.
That was fantastic. Jessica, really, it was great to have you on and to get your insights. I hope
Thank
we can
you.
Have you back sometime.
I'd enjoy that.
Okay, well, Sex and the City is in theaters everywhere now. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, I'm sure many of your listeners join me in feelings of uncertainty, having realized that the people from whom I get the majority of my movie advice may have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. Your disgruntled and gruntled emails and more next in Listener Feedback. Stay with us.
I came home from your bed in the morning of the new day. I came home your bed, on your pillow I laid my head, in my long dress, my high heels, my fancy stockings, I was walking home. from a long night in my long dress, my high heels, my fancy stockings. I was walking home from a long night in the bright light of day.
Hey guys, it's Eric in Chicago, a longtime podcast listener, and I, after going to the midnight premiere of Indiana Jones, just had to add to what I'm sure is a huge pile of voicemail from people just acknowledging how incredibly decimated our childhoods are by George Lucas and Spielberg. I can't think of anybody who's done more to completely destroy the fundamental things that made me love movies to begin with as a kid.
Hey guys, it's Mark calling from Dallas. I just wanted to chime in on Indy 4. I'm a little shocked that you guys are giving this movie a pass, but before I get on with the rest of my life and forget that the movie ever happened, I just got to say, I think a lot of people are going to want to blame George Lucas for anything they don't like about the movie, but I think you have to hold Steven Spielberg's feet to the fire on this one. The direction in this is so incompetent, badly staged, uninventive. I have my trilogy. I'm happy. I just want to pretend that I never saw this movie.
Welcome back to Film Spotting alongside Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. A couple of voicemails there, Maddie. I'm telling you, forget the Russians, forget the Nazis. The toughest test Indiana Jones may ever face, the fiercest adversaries may be Film Spotting listeners. They were absolutely relentless in their feedback this week.
And for the first time since I've actually been here, they have turned on you.
Yeah.
They have turned on you, my friend.
Mr. Sensible.
You of the safe, easy, you know, opinion. Finally, the masses have turned against you, against their golden cow.
Well,
it's about time.
It is true. It really did happen. We will get into all of your Indiana Jones feedback next week on the show. I'm going to be cowering in the corner as we record because I'm absolutely terrified. It really is unbelievable how many people just absolutely hated Indiana Jones 4, along with Eric and Mark. And again, we will get to that next week on the show. And we do want to know, though, what you think. Maybe some of you really did like it and you just haven't come out of the woodwork yet. You can share your thoughts in our poll question this week. We're asking you to finish this sentence: Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull
lived up to the hype, was okay, not the worst in the franchise, was a big disappointment, or obviously haven't seen it yet.
And I think actually, even though I did like the movie quite a bit more than you did, Maddie, we'd both say it's okay, not the worst in the franchise.
No, I'm
going disappointment.
I'm
going
to go disappointment, okay. Because what I said was it's fine for what it is, but it is not an Indiana Jones film.
Fair enough. We do want to know what you think, though. Make your voice heard at filmspotting.net and vote in the poll question. Last week's poll question, we needed your help. Doing a little Film Spotting housekeeping here. We're looking ahead to the weekend of June 6th, and it's an absolutely brutal weekend for new movies. We want to know what you think we should review. So we asked you this question: should Film Spotting mess with the Zohan on June 6th? Of course, referencing the new Adam Sandler film. Here are your choices. Yes, it might actually be funny. No, review Jack Black and Kung Fu Panda instead, the DreamWorks animated film. Or three, no, review anything but Zohan or Panda. Maddie, what are we doing?
Number one, we got to find out what's playing in the art house, because no, review anything but Zohan or Panda, overwhelmingly at number one, 47%. Number two, yes, it might actually be funny, 29%. No, review Kung Fu Panda, 24%.
And at this point, we actually aren't completely sure what we're going to do. Zohan, it looks like, is definitely out. We may end up talking about Kung Fu Panda. We also are curious about the promotion. I think we did mention this last week on the show. This is a Chicago movie. John C. Reilly's in it, and it does look pretty funny. We may talk about that film. We may also dig into the art house a little bit and check out Reprise, which I know actually is a film, Maddie, that you saw over the weekend, and we'll hold off on any comments there. But maybe that, maybe Kung Fu Panda. We will have to see next week. Of course, check the Film Spotting calendar at filmspotting.net for updates. Before we really dive into the mailbag, we did want to share a quick correction. Maddie, I know you've been dying to set the record straight on this all week now. This email from Emma Standring Trueblood in Oak Park, California. Maddie, how can you call the delightful Kristen Chenoweth Ellen? I'd expect better of you, though she would be wonderful in a Nick and Nora revival. She was one of your picks along with Tom Hanks last week. Top five heroes who need a comeback. You said Kristen Chenoweth. should be Nora Charles, but you called her Ellen. But there's actually a really good reason why you made that mistake.
I do that all the time.
Well,
I conflate those names all the time.
Right.
I confused her with Ellen Chenoweth. Ellen Chenoweth is the head of Ellen Chenoweth Casting, award-winning casting director for many, many, many films. You've seen her name several times. And Ellen Chenoweth, if you are listening, I don't know if you remember this or not. 2 years ago at the Mark Taper Forum, I was in a conversation with you, and he asked me actually to send in my headshot. I don't know what happened.
Haven't heard from her?
I haven't heard from her.
Wow.
I haven't heard from her, yeah.
Shocking.
Yeah, bizarre.
That's
bizarre
really
how that
too
works.
Bad.
But you can see where my head's at.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, let's dive in then and get some thoughts on a recent top five list, Maddie. A couple weeks ago, we talked about the new David Mamet film, Red Belt. Of course, Mamet really known for his great snappy dialogue. So we did our top five all-time favorite dialogue scenes. It was a really tough list to come up with because you're talking about the entire catalog of every film ever made and all the great dialogue that's ever been uttered. We did get a lot of great responses like this one from Ryan here.
Hey guys, this is Ryan Foley from Denver, Colorado. I sit here today in utter shock. Having just listened to your top five dialogue scenes, the fact that neither of you saw fit to honor Quentin Tarantino, the greatest writer of dialogue for the screen in history of film, is beyond me.
It's a bold statement.
Personally, my number one would have been the final scene of Pulp Fiction, but you could have picked just about any scene from any one of his movies. I'm sure many of your listeners join me in feelings of uncertainty, having realized that the people from whom I get the majority of my movie advice may absolutely have no idea what they're talking about.
Ouch. I'm really sorry that Ryan is just now coming to this realization, but speaking of any scenes from any one of his movies, Liz Rocher in New Haven, Connecticut writes in with her top five list, and her number five is Reservoir Dogs. The opening scene from Reservoir Dogs is amazing. All the guys at the table, Madonna, sex, guns, the night the lights went out in Georgia, and a discussion on tipping. Number four, Brick. Seriously, where was this film, even in your honorable mentions? This whole film is sharp, quick dialogue. Of course, Liz is absolutely right there, Maddie, but I think listeners have actually put a moratorium on us mentioning the movie Brick here on the show. Number three, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Mr. Smith storms into Clarissa Saunders' office and demands that they get to work right away on his new bill for a national boys' camp. What follows is a wonderful, if subdued, 10-minute back and forth. Number two, Before Sunrise. Adam, I can't believe that you can't recall any dialogue scenes from Before Sunrise. The one that stands out for me is when Jesse and Celine are at the table at an outdoor cafe and the old fortune teller comes up to them and reads her palm. It was the first example in the film of the two of them sharing a different opinion, and it's wonderful to watch Jesse tell her what he thinks only to realize that he likes this girl and might want to tread lightly. Of course, that whole film is filled with great dialogue. Number one for Liz, though, is Chasing Amy. Maddie, Clerks 2? What the hell? Look at Kevin Smith's body of work, and you can clearly see that Chasing Amy is the culmination of comedy, romance, dialogue, acting, heart, feeling. Smith has never been better than he was with Chasing Amy. There are a ton of great dialogue scenes in the film, but my choice is the scene near the beginning where Holden and Alyssa are in the bar before he discovers that she's a lesbian. Maddie, I cannot believe you let Clerks 2 edge out any other film on your honorable mentions list.
I don't know what it is about Chasing Amy. Kind of like me in Sex and the City, I never got that movie.
Really?
I just never got it. It never really registered with me. For whatever reason, the brilliance of Kevin Smith didn't really shine through for me until Clerks 2. In fact, I'm not a big Clerks fan, the original.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go on record as admitting that. Or Dogma. I really can't stand
like Dogma
that film either.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Chasing Amy was the film for me where he really put it all together and then got it back with Clerks 2 a little bit. So.
Well, John Crawford writes in, he says, I thought your dialogue top five was good, full of iconic moments, but how on this great green earth did you fail to include anything from Monty Python and the Holy Grail? There are so many classic bits wherein the comedy hinges on the dialogue. It's just a flesh wound. Oh, but you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you. Even the subtitles are funny dialogue. For shame, gentlemen, for shame. I fear that those who came up with the top five should be sacked.
Well, Maddie, I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you a question that may forever alienate you from our listeners.
Uh-oh.
Will a Monty Python film ever make a Maddie Ballgame top five list?
The Life of Brian could be number one on several of my lists.
Okay.
Easy, easy. This one, I sound like a broken record. It's not one of those I go around quoting.
I really,
for whatever reason, I think it's fun. I think it's kind of irreverent. But again, the genius of Python and the sort of really biting satire is more present for me in Life of Brian and actually The Meaning of Life than anything in The Holy Grail.
Well, I'm with you actually on both of those films maybe being better than Holy Grail. I ask that question just because for me, I don't know that it ever will. I like the Monty Python guys. I like the films. I do not love those films. I'm with you. I'm not one of those guys who goes around quoting those. I sort of feel like I missed the boat on the Monty Python thing somehow. So I'm sorry, John, for some reason, I don't know that it's going to make any of my future listening way, but we will see. I do like The Life of Brian.
Well, if we really want to alienate some people, I'll say it right now. I cannot stand the Flying Circus television series.
Wow.
Send in your hate mail. Care of
feedback.
Adam Kempinar at
filmspotting.net. This one from Sheridan in London, UK. Not even an honorable mention for Heathers, the mold-breaking dark teen comedy that pretty much put traditional teen comedies on hold for a decade. Granted, it may not be your kind of movie, but there's no denying the sharpness of its script. A continuous stream of witty exchanges and one-liners, dishing out plenty of postmodern self-referential banter years before Tarantino, there he is again, made a career out of it. How can you not love the moment when the heroine, Veronica, confronts her increasingly murderous boyfriend, JD, with the line, "You're such a rebel? You think you're a rebel? You're not a rebel. You're effing psychotic." To which he responds, "Maddie, how's your Slater slash Nicholson?"
You say tomato, I say tomato.
There you have it. Incidentally, the same writer-director team, Daniel Waters and Michael Lehman, are also responsible for one of the movies you shamefully admitted to not having seen while discussing your top five bombs, the way ahead of its time and much misunderstood, Hudson Hawk. Wow.
Wow. Like it's a bad kindergartner.
I know.
I have never heard anyone defend that film.
No, I haven't either. And that's a pretty big fall to go from Heathers, which I do agree is a pretty fun,
film
with some great dialogue, some nice satire in it of high school, to then go to Hudson Hawk. Then again, what can I say? I haven't seen it. Maybe it's not that bad.
All right. Well, Luke Siemens writes in from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, my favorite province to say on air. Number five, he's got The Third Man, of course, the Ferris wheel scene. Number four, The Seventh Seal between the church painter and John's the squire. Number three, Manhattan. Has anybody read The Nazis Are Going to March in New Jersey? This is Woody Allen at his best, a one-liner style joke blended with one of Allen's themes, making fun of the intellectual class in which he belongs. Number two, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Harry says, "I've got a five that says you could still get him."
Really? That's funny. I have a ten that says pass the pepper. I have two quarters that say Harmony Moonlight in Vermont.
I love this scene in Shane Black's postmodern noir jest. It tries to recall the great hard-boiled dialogue from the 40s, although the main character just doesn't get it. And number one, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I know, a film spotting favorite here.
Yes.
"I can't see anything that I don't like about you."
But you will. But you will. You know, you will think of things, and I'll get bored with you and feel trapped because that's what happens with me.
Okay.
Okay.
Often great dialogue is remembered because it hits on something that feels true, no matter how stylized the words may be. For me, this conversation in Eternal Sunshine embodies everything about romantic pain and pleasure in four lines. Really nicely said.
Really well put. We agree completely, Luke. A great pick there. I do want to mention one last Quentin Tarantino note. Philippe in Montreal, Canada, mentioned that he couldn't believe that we didn't include True Romance. Of course, the great scene between Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper. He said it was the first one that came into
his mind. That's the scene that I would include because, and this is my caveat with Quentin Tarantino, the man is a gifted director and a great writer. Yada, all hail Tarantino. But the fact of the matter is a lot of that dialogue is so irreverent and ultimately doesn't move the plot forward. I know that's something I harp on, but that True Romance scene actually does exist for a reason. It's not just talking about pop culture references and so forth and that witty banter that we love. It actually serves a purpose in the film.
Yeah, definitely. I see what you're saying. Why don't we go ahead and close out the segment with this one from Sam Watermeyer in Carmel, Indiana.
All right, here's number one. The Matrix, Agent Smith interrogates Morpheus. "Human beings define their reality through misery and suffering. The perfect world is something your primitive cerebrum kept trying to wake up from." Come on, dialogue doesn't get much better than that. Number two, The Departed, DiCaprio and Nicholson in the restaurant near the end. The tension between DiCaprio and Nicholson in this scene is unbelievable. Nicholson is right on DiCaprio's tail, and DiCaprio's frantic delivery is very, very powerful. Number three, Lost in America.
This is great.
After his wife gambles a lot of money away in a Las Vegas casino, Albert Brooks tries to convince the casino manager to give the money back. He uses the holiday spirit trick and says that if he gives the money back, he could put up a billboard that says, "Las Vegas, the Christmas place to be."
Poor Julie Haggerty gives away their entire nest egg at the casino.
I do have to say, for me, that's the best scene in that film, and otherwise, I can't stand that.
Really?
Movie.
I think it's decent. I think it's good.
Really?
I think it made
downhill.
My road movies list.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they get as far as Vegas, and that's it.
No.
And then they go to Arizona, right?
No, they travel around. They go to Hoover Dam. You're right. They don't get very far after that. They
Dullsville.
Have no money.
Number four, American Psycho, any scene with the Patrick Bateman character and his friends. This is such sleazy, yuppie dialogue that makes you hate these characters and crack up laughing at the same time because of how ridiculously offensive they are.
You like Huey Lewis in the news, Maddie? How about Phil Collins?
Number five, Rushmore, the dinner scene. Max Fisher is such a jerk in this scene, and his dialogue creates so many awkward, intense moments, like when he declares his love for Miss Cross and makes fun of her friend, played by Luke Wilson. All good choices.
Maxies are O.R. scrubs. Oh, are they? One of my favorite lines in that entire film from that scene. Well done, Sam. Lastly, Maddie, I will just quickly mention, because I'm such a big fan of the Jim Rome show, apparently, JB in the D says, thanks for the respect given to the classics, but there's one scene that just sticks out in my mind. What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss? This scene of dialogue in No Country for Old Men between Gene Jones and Javier Bardem is an instant classic and should not be forgotten. The movie would not have been complete without it. He's absolutely right.
Did I or did I not call it the best 5 minutes of film captured in 2007?
I believe you did. Well done, Maddie. We appreciate all the great feedback we got. We have a ton more responses I wish we could get to. If you have any thoughts for us about the show or your favorite dialogue scenes, email them to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and Logan's Run envisions a world where everyone dies at 30. Oh, thank God I've got four more years. Stay with us. They're writing love songs in my brain. Drives me insane, and these voices in my head saying things we never said. Will I always want you? Will I always?
Maddie, it's time now to announce the winners of our recast Raiders of the Lost Ark contest, of course brought to you by Spout. You can check out all of the entries over at recast.spout.com. Some great stuff there. The first place winner is going to get some great American Apparel Spout swag, and the second prize winner is going to get Speed Racer, The Next Generation, the beginning on DVD. And Adam from Spout, one of the judges over there at Spout, was nice enough to shed some light on what their criteria is when they're considering these lists. They had a really tough time with it, as you would expect. And he mentioned that they're looking for ideas that instantly make us fans of your movie. Your post is a pitch. If we're holding $9, would we fork it over to see your film? Some signs that you're writing a winning post: you make yourself laugh, or you get that wide-eyed eureka feeling, or you spend a lot of time daydreaming about how that scene in Ghostbusters would play out if Michael Cera was the student who gets zapped. And he says, you know, an idea's possibility doesn't really matter necessarily. On the other hand, if there's a coherence to it, like, you know, that great Robert Altman version of The Princess Bride, sometimes that will end up helping a little bit. But he says, you know, it's not a case of snobbery either, where it has to be something really high class to be good. Some criteria there on how they pick their winners. And for the second place prize, they went with Dan's Inch for imagining a cult classic that never was. Adam says he's a big fan of Raiders and Big Trouble in Little China, but I think I like this movie more than either of those.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Carpenter's Raiders of the Lost Ark as Indiana Jones, the one, the only, Kurt Russell, as Marion Ravenwood, the one, the only, Kim Cattrall, of course,
why not,
the star of Porky's, as Dr. Renee Belloc, Sam Neill, as Major Arnold Tote. I do like this one. This is the melting Nazi guy.
Yes.
Stephen Tobolowsky.
That's right. Ned Ryerson. Ding.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. This one's a bit of a stretch. Sala, Wilford Brimley. Of course, Wilford Brimley was in The Thing.
Yes, so he was.
We'll go with Hal Holbrook as Dr. Marcus Brody. As Satipo, he's going with Dennis Dunn.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know who that
is. Okay.
As Colonel Dietrich, Jeff Bridges, wondering if he can do a German accent. I'm not quite sure. And as Major Eaton, of course, you've got to go with Donald Pleasance,
yeah,
the president, of course, from Escape from New York. He was also in The Great Escape as well. Great,
and
great
Halloween.
Actor. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So a great entry there. Congratulations to Dan's Inch. You do win that copy of Speed Racer, The Next Generation on DVD. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, to claim your prize. Our next winner, though, you're going to get contacted directly by Spout, and we want to say congratulations to
Plant Page 55. He offers, as Indiana Jones, Clive Owen.
Now, he was going to give it to Daniel Craig, but he already has a legitimate action franchise, so he thinks Clive needs one.
That works.
Also, he's got a good stubble face.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Rachel Weisz as Marion Ravenswood. I could see that, but mm-hmm. she's got the mummy thing already.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Matthew Almerich, of course, one of your favorite films from last year.
Yeah.
And I like this pick, Mads Mikkelsen as the melting Nazi.
Why not?
Benicio del Toro as Sala. Richard Dreyfuss as Dr. Marcus Brody. I like that pick.
Mm-hmm.
John C. Reilly as Satipo, although we think Alfred Molina probably could still do it. Jude Law as Colonel Dietrich, Jeffrey Rush as Major Eaton, and Don Cheadle as the cameo as the main guy from the ship, the Nazis board looking for Imdi. That's a great one. And Chim Chim from Speed Racer as the bad date monkey. He also throws in Thomas Hayden Church, a little cameo as the guy who pilots the plane for Indy in the opening sequence.
Why not? He was on Wings after all.
That's right.
Great stuff there from Plant Page 55 and, of course, from Dan Zinch. Congratulations to both of you. And, of course, you can visit recast.spout.com to check out all of those entries, past entries, and our next contest, which we don't know yet what film we want you to recast next, but look for that announcement at spout.com. Of course, the web address, once again, recast.spout.com. Thanks again to everybody who entered.
My fate is incomplete.
Well, I'm not surprised driving a field car.
Field car? What's field car?
Field car runs through the fields, drops cow shit all over the place to make the lettuce grow.
That's pretty good. Hey, I like the color of your car there, man. What's that supposed to be? Sort of a cross between piss yellow and puke green, ain't it?
Well, you call that a paint job, but it's pretty ugly. I bet you got to sneak up on the pumps just to get a little air in your tires.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show wherein Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a free beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard with Harrison Ford and Paul LaMotte from George Lucas's American Graffiti, a tie-in, of course, with our review of Indiana Jones 4, although I refuse to call it Indiana Jones 4.
Well, that's fair enough, but apparently the line there that Harrison Ford has is Bob Falfa, where he says that the car is a mix between piss yellow and puke green. That gave it away for a lot of listeners. It is a great scene. And also, Maddie, I just want to quickly throw out there that if I was going to form my list of the top five movies that have great endings but then kind of screw it up and shoot themselves in the foot with text, a little textual epilogue at the end of the film, American Graffiti is one of them. It should have just ended on its great final shot and has to instead tell us what happens with the characters down the road. It doesn't work.
I stopped listening to you 30 seconds ago, so why don't you reach into that hat and pick out this week's winner.
What else is new? And the winner is Jeannie Kautzman in Spokane Valley, Washington.
Home of Gonzaga University.
Are you sure about that, Maddie?
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, Jeannie or Jean, we're not sure exactly. Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now you guys gotta look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
Maddie, we move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and I don't think any kind of setup is needed. Let's jump right into the scene. You started off, I'm gonna give you the action. And action.
You've got one of the worst reputations in this town, Blank. Nobody will hire you.
Are you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limiting. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You played a tomato for 30 seconds. They went half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato. A tomato doesn't have logic. A tomato can't move.
That's what I said. So if he can't move, how's he going to sit down, Blank? I was a stand-up tomato, a juicy, sexy beefsteak tomato. Nobody does vegetables like me. I did an evening of vegetables off-Broadway. I did the best tomato, the best cucumber. I did an endive salad that knocked the critics on their ass.
And
scene.
Really nicely done, Mr. Campanar.
Well, I tried. That's a hard impression to do, and I know I didn't sound anything like the actor there, but it's a tough one. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net by Wednesday, June 4th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
You can have any woman in the city. What do you really want? Why show me?
Because I'm going to run.
Why, tell me.
You know something.
About running? Dying? What?
Both, but running is what I'm interested in.
I know what everyone knows. Try like hell for a no. You have the same chance as anyone else. Carousel.
Look, don't you understand? It's different now because it's me, my life.
Maddie, sometime in the 23rd century, the survivors of war, overpopulation, and pollution are living in a great dome city, sealed away from the forgotten world outside, here in an ecologically balanced world.
Adam, I hate to interrupt you.
Yes, Michael York?
Have you ever seen anyone renewed?
Lives only for pleasure, freed by the servo mechanisms which provide everything. I'm taking this, of course, from the preamble to the film Logan's Run from 1976. There's just one catch. Life must end at 30 unless reborn in the fiery ritual of carousel.
Are you going to carousel?
Is played by Michael York, who is apparently in studio with us. He's a sandman. He's basically a cop. He stops the runners, the people who don't believe in renewal, don't believe in carousel, want to escape to what they think is sanctuary, the world outside. And maybe in keeping with the trippiness of this film, Maddie, I wanted to share a brief email from one of my favorite nicknamed listeners, John, it ends when I say it ends, Bissell, from Vernon Hills, Illinois, which just even sounds like it belongs in the 70s sci-fi marathon as far as nicknames go. He wrote in and said, one suggestion for your viewing of Logan's Run, you can watch it synced up with Kraftwerk's Autobahn album, and it fits perfectly, much like the Wizard of Oz Dark Side of the Moon combo. All the electronic German sounds are a perfect fit for the goofy action, and there are a bunch of moments where the propulsion of the songs match perfectly with the action on screen. My question for you, Maddie, is, having watched Logan's Run and not watched it in this state, do you wish you had maybe had the Kraftwerk experience? Would it have made the movie more enjoyable, or was it great on its own?
Dude, that's so unfair. I mean, come on. Kraftwerk is going to save any film. I mean, please. Uh-huh. You could put it on, you know, Schindler's List. It's going to make it a better film. You know, this film, it's ambitious, okay? I think all of our films...
That's like saying it has a nice personality, isn't it, Maddie?
No, it's terrible. No, it's absolutely not terrible. I think it's sort of... You know, every single one of our films have really dealt with, you know, the possible end of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of imagine that the world in Logan's Run is the world that the crew of the Valley Forge are hovering over in Silent Running. I mean, it's great. You get the dial-up sexual partners in the circuit. Your daily entertainment is watching people become, you know, renewed through this elaborate ceremony. What I was hoping it was going to become was sort of a critique of fascist religion, you know, sort of the opiate for the masses. I mm-hmm. love movies that dissect the psychology of faith. But this movie, unfortunately, what it wants to do is it wants to show you ray guns shooting, and it wants to show you a chase, and it wants to show you fist fights. And at the end, I don't know if you felt this, I was left with a huge question mark. When you pull the curtain back on this society, who was the wizard?
Wow, we had the same
reaction.
Who
was the wizard?
Yeah.
And you know what it stems from? And I don't mean to be trite, but you know, we're dealing with the fallout from the cyclones in Myanmar. And basically, we have all these people, these thousands of people that are being denied help by this junta that is running this country. We don't really know much about this junta. I wanted to know who the hell this junta was that was running this domed society.
Yep.
We don't get that.
No, and Maddie, I am right there with you. And in fact, that was actually going to be maybe my setup for you with something along those lines, because we hear in that intro that I read that everyone is freed by the, quote, servo mechanisms. Okay, so everything's automated, and we certainly see that computers seem to run the show. But that lack of authority was really problematic for me, because somebody has to run those computers,
right?
Don't they? Or at least someone had to create the computers.
It's just some computer head.
Right. It didn't make sense. And you know, who did it? What happened to them? How can nobody know for sure if anyone has been renewed?
Because as we find out, we're not that far removed in terms of generations from the end of society,
right?
Because we're going to meet Peter Ustinov later on as the old man.
It just doesn't make any sense that everyone is walking around this world and they still have that question, that they're supposed to be so living in this bliss of pleasure that they don't really think about the fact that, well, hey, I've never seen someone renewed. I'm sorry, I didn't buy it. I think that the movie just opened up a lot of questions that it didn't answer, unlike the movie we reviewed last week, Soylent Green, where it instantly, you know, right off the bat, allowed me to buy into the world of Soylent Green. And this movie just provoked more and more questions for me and left me more frustrated than anything. And, you know, even that pleasurable world, people, you know, you dial them up like on your remote control. You're watching a television set.
Why are you in the circuit?
Exactly. You can have a prostitute just magically appear.
An ankh-wearing prostitute.
That's right. Jenny Agutter, I believe her name, is wearing an ankh. She can show up, and that's great. I guess you can order a prostitute. But otherwise, I'm sorry, this world of Logan's Run, this wonderful domed world, you're pretty much just walking around a mall all day. That's basically the effect I got. I didn't see how it was so great.
No, you're right. And this is the first one. I mean, this really takes some determination to get through. The camp is really, really apparent because the special effects, which is what it's relying on to entertain you, are not that
good.
They're not. They're really glaringly not that good. And it's funny because the next year, Star Wars, of course, is going to usher in a whole new world. I will say, I think it starts to pick up a little bit when he's running outside the dome. It starts to pick up a little bit, but then it really starts to die. We spend so much time when it gets to this Planet of the Apes, you know, Washington society there. It just labors, but it is only saved.
No, it's not.
It is only saved.
It's not saved.
Just for entertainment value by the great Mr. Ustinov.
Oh, man.
I don't know what he's doing. I don't think anybody on the set knows what he's doing. And it works. It really, really works.
No, Maddie, it really doesn't work.
No, it completely works. And it reminded me a lot of Orson Welles in Touch of Evil. Because that performance is so sort of over. You know the performance I'm talking
about
where
he's
talking over and he's grunting all the time, you know, interrupting people. He sort of introduces a sort of new style of acting. And it's sort of alienating in that film. And it sort of starts Welles on this very obvious path of self-destructive behavior because you can see what he's doing. That there was he's basically giving the finger to the studio.
Okay.
And here, it actually works more than Welles in that performance.
No.
No, it totally does.
Well,
it totally
I'll give
does.
You all I'll
he,
give you.
He's not given that much to say, but I really love
I felt like he talked endlessly.
I love that character.
Well,
I love that character.
I hated it, and I was looking forward to seeing Peter
Ustinov. You liked Edward G. Robinson in Soylent Green.
Completely
I thought this
different.
Was the same kind
no,
of thing.
No, completely different.
He's not
I really
given
do.
The same lines.
No, he's not, but I really think here, the only right thing you say about the Touch of Evil comparison is that it is the style of acting where it's almost winking at you. He's having fun. He's deliberately going for something. You see the wheels turning.
Thank
you,
Maddie. It really calls attention to itself.
But the grotesque quality of that works for me in Touch of Evil. Here, Peter Ustinov is really in his own world. And you're right. I don't think anybody on the set really even could probably understand him. I barely understood him. He's an actor who, my read of it is, he was sort of going, what am I doing in this crazy sci-fi movie?
And as a result,
I'm just going to then,
he's
I'm going to say screw it.
Everybody.
He says, I'm going to say screw it and do whatever I want and just act like a cat or something the whole time. That's great. I guess I give him some credit for having fun. But in terms of boring me to death, yes, he did.
I think he injects it actually with an emotional core that this film doesn't have. Because unfortunately, you're acting opposite of Michael York. And look, I love Michael York as he's in the Austin Powers movie. He'll always be D'Artagnan
Cabaret.
To me in the Three Musketeers. But this dialogue is so stilted. And so when that sort of naturalism of Ustinov comes on, I actually really like that dynamic that's created.
Okay. Well, it obviously did not work for me at all. And actually, you know, by the end of the film, too, where we get the big computer showdown input contrary, this big trippy ending,
well, again,
the effects don't really work. And it really was just chaos with no real payoff. And you're right. The thing that was so shocking to me is you hear about the great special effects. Well, let's not forget our friend George Lucas, who sort of ruined Indiana Jones, at least according to most of our listeners. He made THX 1138 in 1971. Mm-hmm. It's 5 years before this movie. Way better. A way better film in every way, and the special effects are way better in terms of envisioning a futuristic world.
Yeah, exactly. I think every single film that we've seen so far, I love the special effects in Silent Running, those shots of the spaceships
I do too.
And so forth.
And I was longing for that here because the key difference, and this really kind of set the tone for the entire film, we again talk about how I believed the world of Soylent Green, the world that this overpopulated world. Instantly, I did not believe this world of Logan's Run. And the reason is because from the opening shot,
you thought you were in the food court.
You can tell, before that though, even the opening shot of the camera moving in on this world, it's so obviously a model that I couldn't get around that fact. I was instantly brought out of the film. Whereas a movie like Silent Running, right from the beginning, again, it's the same kind of model work, but I completely believe that we were out in space. Never bought this world for a second.
Yeah, I'm buying the dystopias that we've seen actually in Omega Man and in Soylent Green much more than this sort of utopia.
Mm-hmm.
It's really never fully realized.
Yeah, it's sort of funny. It actually did get an Academy Award for special achievement for its visual effects. I guess maybe some people obviously saw it as pioneering at the time, but we saw it better in Silent Running.
Yeah.
We saw it better in THX 1138. I don't get it. I did not have much fun with this film, even with its campiness. It wore on me.
This is the first one I have to say. There is a campy, fun element to it, but that's about all I can recommend it for.
Okay. Well, next week, the 70s sci-fi marathon will conclude with another film from 1976, also trippy, The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie. And we should announce, Maddie, that our next marathon, it's going to start the last week in June. So you've got some time here to get ready for this next marathon. It is going to be our classic heist movies marathon. Of course, you'll remember we did our top five heist movies a little while back on the show. I know some listeners made this suggestion. I believe Caroline in London was the first to suggest it, that we should do a heist movie marathon, because we admitted that there were some we really felt bad we hadn't seen. So we are going to do a classic heist movies marathon. It's going to definitely include the Jean-Pierre Melville film, Le Cercle Rouge. It's going to include the Dassin film, Rififi, and the Italian Job.
Oh, good.
The
original. We're doing Rififi. Good.
And the original Italian Job with Michael Caine, of course. But the next three slots are pretty much up for grabs, and we're open to your suggestions or your bribes. Certainly, we will take them. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Send us your comments for that marathon.
And this week, in anticipation of The Man Who Fell to Earth, everybody's invited up to the north side to Maddie's pad. We're going to put on a little station to station, a little low on the turntable.
Okay.
In getting
put some makeup on.
Yeah, maybe even a little craft work.
Why not?
All right, time for a quick break. When we return, Adam plays Andy Sachs to my Miranda Priestly as we count down our top five best dressed characters.
That's Andrea to you.
Stay with us.
Dear, right from these walls, your majesty calls. Sun's beating down on wherever you are. And in my chastity, I want you to see my love's as strong as eternity. It's nighttime when I feel it most. It's the silence, the absence of light, and love's hard, but I'm staying true till the day that I come back.
All right, time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
Coming out on DVD, Maddie, this Tuesday, a movie I think we're both looking forward to seeing again, Control, from director Anton Corbijn. This is the movie, of course, about Joy Division, or more specifically about the lead singer,
yes,
Ian Curtis. And I will mention that anyone out there who is curious about this film and maybe Ian Curtis, you can, of course, check out my interview with the star of this movie, Sam Riley, from the Toronto Film Festival at filmspotting.net. Click on our interviews page. Also out, Dirty Harry, the Ultimate Collector's Edition. It includes all five Dirty Harry films and some new special features. Also, The Andromeda Strain, the first film, the second film in our 70s sci-fi marathon. That's out now. This is the new version, the A&E miniseries. It's a two-disc collection, Maddie.
What, did this come out this year?
Yeah, actually, I think it just aired actually a couple weeks ago or over Memorial Day. I know I TiVo'd it, but I haven't watched it yet. But it's a new version. Also out, speaking of heist movies, Maddie, Flawless. This is the Demi Moore Michael Caine film that you reviewed on the show and said was okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I actually think it's worth a rental if you sort of like those heist films. It's really nice.
Vince Vaughn's Wild West Comedy Show. I believe this was the topic of a Maddie's Movie Minute.
Right. If you like stand-up comedy, there are moments of joy here. But as
moments.
A film, it just doesn't quite work.
And then I just have to throw this out here, Maddie. The one and only. This is a film from 1978 starring the Fonz, Henry Winkler. Have you ever even heard of this film?
No.
Okay. I caught this one night. I know I was home from college. I'm sleeping on the couch. It's like 3 a.m. I can't get to sleep. And this crazy movie comes on with the Fonz playing a guy who like moves to New York and he wants to be a big time actor or something. And he gets involved in wrestling. He's this weakling of a guy. He's small Henry Winkler, but he's going to be a wrestler. And so he sort of ends up kind of inventing wrestling because he turns it into just about the showmanship of it, mm-hmm, and being a clown. It's a crazy little movie that, again, I caught, you know, about 15 years ago at 4 a.m. I just wanted to mention it. It's out on DVD now.
Now it gets a DVD release. I am going to cue that one up.
Check it out.
Time now for donations. We want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we really are truly humbled by each and every donation, and it goes a long, long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. So thank you, thank you, thank you to Joanne in Melbourne,
Victoria, Australia, Brendan in Chicago, Kristen in Utah. I'm gonna go with Utah.
That's what it looks like.
Alabama, Matthew from Manhattan, the one in Kansas, and Brian in beautiful Grand Haven, Michigan. Grand Haven, Michigan, home to the largest musical fountain, I believe, in the world, a beautiful little town there on the shores of Lake Michigan.
And a Gold Club donation from Brian. We really thank him for that.
And also remember that for every $10 that you donate, your name is entered into the Film Spotting Hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab. It's found at the top of the page.
That's right. We work for you. You pay us money. We review what you want. And the next After Hours review will be 1963's The Haunting from Robert Wise. We announced that a week or two ago on the show. And the next After Hours show right now, we're pegging for Tuesday, June 10th. But next Friday's podcast, the June 6th show, is when we will announce our next Listener's Choice winner. So if you still want to get in on that action, get your name in the hat, you can do so this week. We will announce it next week.
Sweet, it's my memory of you and of me. Naked and clean, just like Adam and Eve.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and of course, tying in with our discussion of Sex and the City and the influence that television series has had on fashion. Everyone wants to be like Carrie and Miranda and all the girls. We thought we would get in on the girly fun this week and share our top five list of our best dressed movie characters. Maddie, how did you form your list, and what's your number five?
Well, I'm going down not so much the costume vein here. I'm really going for best dress. No kings or queens, you know, royalty or drag. So no Shakespeare in Love or Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Really, just someone with a sense of style, and really that's saying a lot. And, of course, so much it's about the person wearing the clothes who probably imbues them with that style.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, my number five, all right, this is sort of my giggly pick. Okay, this is really stemming from my own personal sense of style. It's a tie. It's a 70s double feature. One vintage, one retro. I'm going with Eric Bana and Daniel Craig in Munich, and I'm going with Paul Newman in Slapshot.
Okay.
Sansibel pants, leisure suits, bright orange. I love it. And my mother wonders why I have trouble meeting women.
Exactly. I think that really says it all there. Great picks there, Maddie. My list, I'm calling it the Annie Hall Memorial List. Of course, that film has been placed into our pantheon because right away, that's the first movie that popped into my head thinking about how influential Diane Keaton's dress in that film was. A lot of people wanted to kind of go for that Annie Hall look. But my number five, it is the one exception on my list where I did try to go with characters who I do like their sense of style, but that their fashion sense or their style plays a role somehow in the story. Mm-hmm. It does factor into the story a little bit. This is the one exception to that, at least as far as I can remember this movie, but I couldn't help it just because I love the look so much, and I'm going with Elliot Ness in The Untouchables. It's just a case where immediately when I think about a well-dressed guy, I picture those three-piece suits from the late 1920s that Kevin Costner is wearing, and of course with the great hat to go with it, kind of that Indiana Jones fedora almost, but the great three-piece suits, those tweeds and those gray jackets, I just think he looks great in that movie, and it was an image that popped into my head right away.
Yeah, it's one that I thought of as well, and I also thought of Eddie Murphy in Harlem Nights.
Hmm.
Really just beautiful. I love that 1920s era, you know, the great Gatsby. Mia Farrow is gorgeous in that film. All right, well, my number four is Maggie Gyllenhaal in Secretary. She wears these absolutely gorgeous vintage blouses with these sort of pencil skirts.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very chic, really nicely done.
Yeah, that is a great pick and one that didn't occur to me, but you're right, she looks great in that movie. My number four, I am sticking with the same time period as my Elliot Ness pick, and I know I'm all alone in liking this actress as much as I do, but I'm going with Faye Dunaway as Bonnie Parker in Bonnie and Clyde. Brought back that 1930s gun mall look and made it very fashionable when Bonnie and Clyde came out. You've got the beret she's wearing. She's got like a bandana around her neck, these long pleated skirts, the cable knit sweaters. That really was a look all to itself, the Bonnie Parker look, and I just think it's fantastic.
All right. Well, my number three is
Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11.
I thought about Brad Pitt as well.
Dude, yeah. For the love of God, the man doesn't need any help looking sexy. But in this film, he just blows sexy out of the water. I've been trying to copy that open top button under the jacket. I just can't do it.
No, it's not happening, is it?
It's
but
ugly.
He pulls it off.
Yeah.
A great pick there. My number three, the pinnacle of class and refinement. I don't know how else to say it. Lisa Carroll Fremont, Grace Kelly in Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. In fact, she's so refined and so classy that it's actually too much for Jeff. Of course, he thinks she's too perfect, but Grace Kelly really is so perfect in that film in terms of the way she looks that you can understand why his character would feel burdened by her beauty in that film.
Yeah, that's a great pick. I was thinking of her in To Catch a Thief. Mm. Absolutely gorgeous in that as well. And my number two, Doris Day in Pillow Talk.
Mm.
Oh my God, those gorgeous... I don't know the name for the dresses. I was actually talking about this with somebody today. They're not shift dresses, and they're not what they call house dresses. They're just these gorgeous numbers that she's wearing with these matching coats. Beautiful, beautiful. Of course, a great film with Rock Hudson.
Unfortunately, I'm not one to help you out with the names of those dresses. I just don't get fashion and know that kind of world, unfortunately, but a great pick. My number two, let's go ahead and hear a scene.
Whoa, very nice. Look at that.
Picked them up from the printers yesterday.
Good coloring.
That's bone. And the lettering is something called Cillian Braille.
It's very cool, Bateman, but that's nothing.
Look at this.
That is really nice. Eggshell with Romalian type. What do you think?
And that, of course, is a scene Christian Bale as Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. That role is all about that character, the Bateman character, is all about the superficial. It's a world where appearance is everything, and everything about the way he dresses, he is absolutely impeccable. It has to be perfect, and I love it.
Why don't you just put Gordon Gekko on your list?
Actually, a great pick, Maddie.
Wow. Wow. All right, well, my number one, Audrey Hepburn. And this is a tough one because I need to pick an actual performance. I love the handkerchief look in Roman Holiday, but she's a princess in that, so that doesn't count. I love the black dress in Breakfast at Tiffany's, but I have to go with Sabrina because not only does it have a tight-fitting black dress, but it's got that beautiful black and white gown. Audrey Hepburn, mwah.
Yeah, she had to make the list, and in fact, you just ruined my number one. Let's go ahead and hear a scene from my number one, though.
Do you see what I mean? How nothing bad could ever happen to you in a place like this? It isn't that I give a hoot about jewelry except diamonds, of course. Like that. What do you think?
Well,
of course, personally, I think it'd be tacky to wear diamonds before I'm 40.
Well, Maddie, I did, of course, consider Sabrina, but I ended up going with the iconic Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's there. And I am aware of this from having four younger sisters that what Audrey Hepburn ended up doing in that opening scene, of course, where we see her looking through the window and she's wearing that little black dress. Every girl needs that little black dress. You know, every woman has to own a dress like that. They're all sort of imitating Audrey Hepburn when they put it on, or at least trying to. And just that opening image is so striking from that movie, the sunglasses, her hair up in the early morning. I mean, really, when you think about fashion and you think about the influence that movies have had on fashion, Audrey Hepburn has to be the first name that comes up. And so I love Breakfast at Tiffany's, and her look in that movie had to be my number one. Maddie, what about some honorable mentions? Who did you just leave off?
Rita Hayworth in Pal Joey, Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Sybil Shepherd and Daisy Miller, and as I said, Mia Farrow in The Great Gatsby, Eddie Murphy in Harlem Nights.
Okay, well, for me, I considered Cary Grant, though you could also throw in Ingrid Bergman from Notorious. More Hitchcock, Kim Novak in Vertigo, amazing costumes there. Clueless, Alicia Silverstone, Cher, which girl, and we've even heard this from some of our listeners, which high school girl didn't see the movie Clueless and want her wardrobe? Great stuff. And then another Nick and Nora Charles reference, William Powell in The Thin Man, fantastic stuff, really classy. And then even though you did leave off anyone in drag from your list, just in terms of pure flamboyance and audacity, John Cameron Mitchell as Hedwig in Hedwig in the Angry Inch was an honorable mention for me.
Nice pick. All right, well, those are our top five best-dressed characters. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
opening wide this weekend. Of course, Maddie, Sex and the City and The Strangers, which looks to me to be really just a Funny Games knockoff with Liv Tyler. We will be avoiding that movie. On next week's show, as we mentioned earlier in the show, we're not exactly sure what we're going to do. Some combination of The Promotion or Kung Fu Panda. We may even talk about the movie Reprise, which is an art house movie that's getting a lot of love lately from critics. A note real quick to some of our Chicago area listeners. Wanted to mention that the new film The Fall that is out in theaters now from the director who also did that movie The Cell, Tarsem, he's actually going to be holding some Q&As after some public screenings of The Fall on Sunday, June 1st. So you can get more information about that at filmspotting.net in the notes for this show if you're interested.
Wow, that film looks like a gorgeous feast for the eyes.
It does.
Thanks, as always, to our wonderful listener volunteers, Candace, Frank, and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Ann McHugh and Messenger Records for this week's music. Learn more at messengerrecords.com. We also, of course, want to say thanks again to Jessica Reeves from the Chicago Tribune for stopping by to discuss Sex and the City. Adam, I don't know what to wear. Does this T-shirt scream first date?
Yes, and it screams last date. It's a travesty. Here, wear this instead.
A Film Spotting T-shirt? Why would I break out the fine china for someone I'm not sure about?
Because a Film Spotting T-shirt means you're fun and intelligent, but also dorky, not too aloof, not too cougar on the prowl.
Kind of Deborah Kerr and From Here to Eternity?
Right. Meets Kathleen Turner in Body Heat. Rawr.
Later that night, I got to thinking. Adam was right. While browsing this smorgasbord we call life, whether you're looking for your Montgomery Clift or your William Hurt, the Film Spotting T-shirt, available from filmspottingswag.com, was the way to go. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thank you for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net.
We're going with Wilford Brimley.
Why not?
Wow, I got a food boner right now.
Did you just say boner on the show?
Wait, isn't this After Hours?
No, it's not.
Oh, uh-oh.